Hey, welcome to Playing Conversations. Here's our chat with our friend Ryan Helps, Senior Director of Design at Loop Earplugs.
There he is.
Hey, hey. What have you talked me into?
You got no idea, mate. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, you sound good to meet you finally.
Yeah, great to meet you, man. I think we've nearly connected
many
like
times.
Four or five times over the years, yeah.
Can I just grab some water really quickly?
No. Not allowed.
That's how it was like when he managed me many, many moons ago.
Where do we begin, Rhino? Do we just pretend like we're on a first date and we don't know anything about each other?
I don't know. I think you guys are the experts. I've not done stuff like
yeah.
this before, so I'm happy to see where it goes.
It should feel like, you know, instead of being digitally hopping on and meeting each other, it's like we were in the same place and I finally got to connect with you over a beer and we just like see where the conversation goes. You know, I don't know when the last time you guys caught up was, but Brendan's talked about you. And, you know, I've heard about your experience at Above and the new move, but I think we're a couple rare people who have been under Brendan's leadership over time. So it'd be fun to hear how your earliest experience with him was back in the day.
Yeah, exactly. We can share some traumas, Jason. We'll edit it out later.
Yeah, Jason, do you want to, I don't know, like kick off and share a little bit about your back? If you guys want a minute or two to connect and say g'day and...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much you've heard about me, but Brendan and I were talking about kind of where you guys first overlapped, and he told me that your first job in Hong Kong was with VTech,
yes,
like old school.
Yeah, I mean, that was the very beginning for me. So I moved from the UK and went to VTech. It was like an extension of school, I would say, really just learning to use creative tools, being super close to manufacturing. I think that was what was so exciting about moving to Hong Kong. And just got my head down, did as much as I could, tried to get products out through the funnel and just learn by doing. And was surrounded by some like exceptionally talented South Korean designers that was quite hard to compete with and keep up with. So it was a good extension of school that I really learned a lot there. But even within like a couple of years, it became quite repetitive. And I was really keen to sort of, you know, within the Hong Kong design scene, it was all about going to Philips. And sort of waiting to get the timing right for the door to open. And I was really fortunate after a couple of years that I joined Brendan's team. And I think that was really, not to talk him up too much, but it was kind of the jackpot in that studio at the time. Headphones was, you know, the portfolio to be a creative in. So I was very, very fortunate. Well, I wanted to meet Brendan and Kaz, but, you know, to also work on like just a great portfolio that was really fun for a young creative. And that's kind of where it really started. Design for me, where it became more than just, you know, sitting down, CADing all day, getting some beautiful renders out. Design kind of became a lot more to me, and there was a lot more thinking around it, and I was surrounded by people who kind of understood that I could really learn from. So that was where it really kicked off for me, and I started having a lot of fun.
I told Jason about the time, you told me this, and I can't remember this, but you told me about the first day you came into the studio and Mark Whedon was showing you around and you were super nervous because you were like on your trial period and you thought that people were just going to boot you out because you just didn't make the cut. And here was your knight in shining armor, me. Welcomed you with open arms, gave you a big cuddle and said, welcome to the team, mate.
I don't know if you frightened me more or put me at ease, but you know, I'm a very humble person. So I think it was all to learn then. And I think I actually turned up to Philips in trousers and a shirt, you know, because for me it was like I gotta look like I'm a professional. Very young and naive at the time.
We should have sent you a dress code and said please dress up with a tie.
Probably would have, you know. I think it's so just like really focused on one step at a time progressing, learning stuff that I just didn't want to make any wrong moves back then. So it was quite funny to turn up. I think you had like a black hoodie on, basically gave me a hug and went good day. And I'm like, oh, hello, sir. Very nice to meet you, Brendan. And I was on absolute best behavior. So it was a shock, but it was a good one. And I think throughout my career, probably relaxed more than ever, to be very honest. That's I think that's maybe one of the benefits of being a creative is that, you know, the culture and, you know, sort of cultural codes of the industry are just super open and wear what you want, express yourself however you want to and be yourself. I think that's really a luxury.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that happens around Brendan and Karen is like this, you know, freedom to speak about design and not hold back words, like really be honest and get to the root of a problem or, you know, a concept or a strategy or a solution. My earliest experience with them at Teague in the Boeing studio, it was just like gave me space to go answer problems, but gave me the clarity of where I needed to be exploring, spend my time efficiently, you know, and come back and listen to what I'd thought about, what I'd created. We're lucky guys.
I wanted to, I've never actually thought about that, but you said something that was quite interesting and Jason echoed it a bit. And that is that your value in design and in creative industries is in your perspective. Yeah, I think that's something that we've always just intuitively felt impress upon our team for sure. Like, I just don't have the mental bandwidth to try and direct everyone, nor do I want to. I want everyone to kind of carve their own little path and bring their own voice to the table, because that's what's going to create a unique creative culture. So, yeah, and the few environments, creative environments that I've worked in at other companies for other people where it felt like you couldn't express your point of view, those are places I didn't last too long.
You know, I'll be honest, I was listening to a few of the podcasts just before this as well, not help manage my expectations. I listened to the Stefano Mazzano one, and I think he said something really interesting in that session, which was you felt like really empowered to navigate what was needed to be done with design. And that was kind of the beauty of Philips is, you know, I think you were, the title was consultant, right? Or senior consultant or something like that. So for me, you were like, very senior, because I was quite early in my career, but the fact that you kind of had control over the portfolio and that Philips gave you the mandate to say, we need to do an innovation sprint, or we need to double down on some sort of like UX paradigms. And that's where I think we can win and maybe move the needle in the portfolio, in the market, or from a user experience perspective. And I think that's from a professional perspective, like, that autonomy is really precious, and you don't get that everywhere. And I think I feel like, having known you since then, you've kind of hopefully taken that with you, and maybe Jason hopefully feels that sense of autonomy, and, you know, you share ideas and thoughts and directions of maybe where the focus should be, but you just empower people to do their best work.
Yeah, a little too much. Like, when I tell him to do something, he goes, nah, fuck off.
No, I was going to say that just brought up the way you've looked back at that has clarified a lot of why I approached the experiences I had after working at Teague under Brennan and Karen, and how I ended up coming back to them eventually to find that space again. I would end up beating my head against a wall as culture changed around me, where I came in with the expectation that I was going to come in with a point of view and bring solutions and have a space to present what, you know, that kind of linear growth that I was looking for coming into a new environment, new studio. And eventually, you know, things change and that isn't what I expect, you know, that your expectations aren't being met anymore. And that's when I moved on to the next thing, found that clean space again. And what we've managed to do here at Planko is like create that in basically every project, in our internal concepts and the way we approach everything. And that's something that's really lucky to find.
Yeah, and I think it's super important, right? I was thinking about like the journey that I went on with Above, and me and Brendan talked a lot about like a consultancy or an agency scaling. And I think you kind of, at Above, we were always scaling to try and get the clients or the projects that we wanted. And that was just the mission. It was like, we're growing so that we can do the work that we really want to do. And it's building up to that. And I think one, that's just a really nice, simple mission for a creative of why you're there and what you're trying to do. But also, like, through my career, I find that you never really know anything as a designer, and you need to create a culture where that's okay. Because I think the more you mature, and maybe Planko has been going through this as well the last few years, the more complex programs you get, the more difficult clients you get with bigger challenges and bigger sort of questions that they're asking you, you're not going to know the answer. So you need to create an environment where that's okay, and you're confident in your process that you'll find the solution. And I think maybe earlier in my career, I always looked at like the senior designer and like, that person has all the answers. Unfortunately, that's never the case. Or at least in my experience, you never know the answers. You just grow in confidence that you know how to figure it out and navigate the questions along the way. So
yeah, I think that at Planko, never knowing the answers, I feel Jason will probably echo this. He's been with us for a few years now, I'm grateful and happy to say. So then we must be doing something right. But at the start of every new year, we feel like we're only just beginning, you know? And I think it's a beginner's mindset. Is that a thing? Yeah, we made some great headway the past year, the past 2 years, past 3 years. But to your point about the kinds of projects, clients, values that you want your work to communicate, it is almost like a never-ending pursuit. So the best you can do, and I think this is part of the magic of creative studios, creative agencies, creative people, is that you never get tired of chasing a vision. You know, you're always excited and you're fed creatively by this idea of doing things better, improving yourself, improving your creative process. The further we go down the line, it goes beyond your professional life and into your personal life. So if I, you know, particularly me, fuck, mate, I'm a couple of years off the old half century. You know, health is a thing. So the more that you can look after yourself physically and mentally, the better you're going to be able to perform as a creative.
Yeah, I think that's super important, right? Like managing energy, and that's just really difficult. That's one thing that I struggled with the last few years. Like when you take on more and more responsibility. Got a little kid at home. We live abroad. We don't have a support network in Sweden. So neither of us are from Sweden or Stockholm. You have a team and, you know, you still have this creative passion where, you know, you still want to give creative direction and get involved. And it's a lot of things. You kind of have to learn to force yourself to take breaks, reset, and make sure you come to work with your full energy, because that's really how you're a good leader. And what tends to happen, and what I have done in the past, is that you sort of neglect that and you get yourself kind of dug into a little hole where you're trying harder and harder and harder, and actually it's not really moving the needle anymore. So I don't think it's about you turning 50 soon, mate, although that's a podcast exclusive. But in general, I think it doesn't matter age. I think you can be at the beginning of your career and in the middle or later on down the road. Got to manage your energy to do your best work and to be your best self and take the time to switch off, right? It's important. We just went to South Africa and Namibia. I had a fantastic time. I came back more motivated than ever. I think that's super important that you sort of plan that out through the year and have a rest and look after yourself.
It's funny, we're heading into a new year. You know, we just internally finished a website update, and it's like it really dawns on you as a designer trying to help. We're not really pushing to scale the business, but to, you know, continue to take on more challenging creative projects, and that's the goal, is to continue to find new space. But it is funny how through scale it becomes more of this balance of running a small business in the reality of like the world today, where, you know, your social media, like all those things that you put out to fuel the business, you have to try to frame those as a great creative opportunity and a space to have fun there as much as what is defined for project work. And that's right. Like, I would love to hear a little more about your experience with Above. If I remember correctly, it started with like a combination of a couple agencies or something like that. I'd love to hear a little bit background on that, because moving to like leading, you know, a couple younger designers, that idea of, I don't have all the answers, but man, I do have a lot of experience of how to structure it so that you can go find the answers and not waste your time. And like what you do is going to come out the other side, or you'll have a higher probability of that being the solution. I'd love to hear a little bit about what that experience was like scaling with a business like that, a creative business, and, you know, what's that trajectory feel like?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was at Above for a long time, and I'd only ever been anywhere for sort of like two and a half years before that in my career. So 8 years at Above was like forever, but it actually felt like 5 minutes. It was really crazy. It was such a great experience for me because it evolved in so many different ways over that 8 years that it felt like I was working at a familiar company, but also a slightly different company every time. I was looking for a job in Amsterdam. That's where my partner was at the time. We actually met at Philips when I was working with Brandon. And
she's way smarter than Ryan, by the way.
He's still way smarter than me. So there's no exclusive there. But I really wanted to work in Amsterdam. That's where she was. It's also like a great creative hub for Europe. And I just couldn't get a job. It wasn't working out for me. I was freelancing a little bit. I felt like the industrial design community was exiting that part of Europe at the time. Frog closed down. TomTom kind of went a little bit more towards digital services and all these hardware companies.
Hey, Rhino, can you just put a date, like what year roughly that was?
It would have been 13, 14, around there. So a little while ago now, and of course, you know, this is me looking in and saying, well, where are all these companies now? I want a job, yeah. Right? So probably not the truth, but I think it was the first time I had a specific place I wanted to be, and it became really difficult.
Right.
We had a chat at home, and I said, okay, let's find a job that has a good airport connection, and we'll go from there. That I interviewed literally everywhere, which was kind of fun to see inside a few different agencies, and was lucky enough to get a couple of offers, and I decided to move to above. And back then it was called Howl Studio, H-O-W-L. It was only a few years old then, and I think there was probably 20 creatives.
Do you remember Bilgi?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Bilgi and Jason knows Jason.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
So you know how I got that job?
Did we introduce you to Bilgi?
MPAT did, Michael Patterson.
Oh, MPAT. Okay, cool. Jason knows MPAT too.
I could go on forever about this, so there might be a little bit of a rabbit hole here. Bilgi was interviewing at Design Partners in Ireland, and he declined their offer and went to Teague. And then I applied to Design Partners, and they snapped me up really quickly, particularly because Bilgi left them in the lurch. And I was like, good enough, not Bilgi's level, but I was good enough. So that's why I ended up in consultancy in Europe. We almost crossed paths. And then Bilgi ended up going to HAL. And then I messaged Michael Pattinson and I said, you know, I'm looking for opportunities in Europe. Do you have any people that would be worth introducing me to? And he said, you've got to talk to Bilgi. And that's kind of the door opener for me to joining HAL. It was a boutique, very small agency at the time. We were sharing an office with an engineering firm called Frankly. And then I think by 2017, they decided to merge because we were basically working as one company. You know, whatever design project that came in, there was some engineering work needed doing and vice versa. So business-wise, it was already kind of working in that way. And then we rebranded to Above. And then that's when we really started to kind of scale and take off a little bit when we curated the brand. And I think online, we presented ourselves quite well, added some really good case studies with work from the past with obviously Nokia and Sony Ericsson, but also some of the newer clients that we had, particularly focused in the Nordics. It's quite interesting looking back at this. I think the big growth spurt for the company was when Google, Facebook, Meta were kind of, they'd done all of the US agencies, of which there are a lot of very well-established big names in the US, and were kind of looking for an alternative option and started looking to Europe for what agencies are around. And we were just the kind of right size, right place to compete with some of the bigger agencies on quality, but we cost nothing in comparison because it was quite early. And we were doing 25% of our business in the US for several years. And that just really, really took off for us and gave us the kind of funds to start sort of building the teams and putting in a bit more structure into the company.
Really cool. So many questions. Which way do we take this? You spoke about online, your online presence, because I'm selfishly thinking about Planko and where we're at and where we're going. I mean, it goes without saying, Matt LaCassio, our senior art director, would be like, this is branding 101, but it needs to be said that creating a compelling online presence with beautiful work is going to be your biggest vehicle, right, to attract more of the same. I can imagine there are a lot of agencies out there doing tons of really, really cool projects and great work, but they don't present themselves. You dress for the job that you want, not the job that you have, kind of thing. Above was one of those companies that everyone knew about in their creative circle for a while. Everyone just stopped in, checked out your site, saw what we were doing. And
it's rare when like a site or like an agency lands on your list of like, you're going to manually go type it in every once in a while and check where they're at and check how they're doing. And that's, I think, like the magic spot we have to try to architect here to, you know, continue doing what we love to do. When your groups with us too, engineering and design firms like combined, what was the headcount and like what was the growth like? That's when the growing pains really come, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of things changed. I think when we came together and became Above, we were probably like 50-60 people split between two studios. So it's basically like two kind of like middle size agencies, maybe. I don't know if that's a correct estimate these days, but So two good sized companies coming together. And then I think we tried to scale really quickly and we struggled. There was kind of this number of trying to get to around 100. I'm not sure exactly. I can't remember what it was driven by, but felt like that was the size of business that we felt that we could control comfortably with like the business development teams and obviously the directors and the partners. And we never really got over 100. That has changed now, but we struggled. And I think one of the big transitions that we went through there was, what's our combined offering and how does that differ to the market? And I think for Above, it was always design, technology, hardware, software. And it was like this melting pot of, you know, a lot of connected devices coming out in Scandinavia in general, a lot of digital services. You know, how do we connect the dots between hardware and software and create an offering there that's a bit more seamless? And that, I think, went really, really well. And so we didn't have digital, we didn't have software, and we built up those capabilities over time. And that's how we naturally grew to 100, by growing a part of the business that didn't exist before, rather than just hiring more and more industrial designers and mechanical engineers.
Duplicating.
Yeah.
Redundancies.
I mean, that sounds like I won't say common sense, but that sounds sensible. And for the business enthusiasts out there, when someone says 100 people, 100 headcount, you can basically put a finger in the wind and calculate the revenue that you would need to churn on an annual basis or a quarterly basis. And you're in the probably, the 20 to 30 million to support 100 people at least, I guess. So that sounds daunting for people who are maybe starting young companies, but it's also, it's a little bit of a snowball effect. So to your point, you take the first step, you know, you merge with an engineering team, you rebrand, you present better case studies, and you start to attract the work. And a lot of it's organic as well, as much as it is architected.
I 100% agree with that. I think goes back to what I said earlier about, you know, when you're in the beginning of your career and you look at the senior designer and you think they have all the answers, I think you look at these companies and how they grow and you just expect that that was the plan. And that's so far from reality. I think what was really interesting at Above was there was a lot of partners, a lot of founding partners. I think there was 12. So you have 12 people.
They had to grow to 100 or else they were never going to get paid.
That's very true. That's maybe where some of the headcount figures come from. But yeah, the same as you have a creative team and you want 12 different perspectives of how you can grow and develop and add ideas and curate ideas. You know, you have 12 founders that can bring a slightly different taste of where they see the business can grow. And I think, you know, some are more interested in digital, some more interested in branding, and some, you know, industrial design was just part of their DNA and that was never going to change. And I think that's great because that's how they were able to grow the business. There's a lot of different people to go out and talk to lead and understand like where we can add value and those kind of things. So as its drawbacks, 12 partners, but also has its opportunities. And I think that's maybe a part of how Above in particular grew over the years and really successfully.
The 12 founding partners, that was coming from the time that they joined.
Exactly.
Joined up the two groups. Yeah. And that was kind of the critical moment to like redefine or like take the best of the culture that you need to define with this new name and this new entity to take forward. And I feel like that's probably where you can get that wrong. Whereas it seems like Above had clarity of like their mission, you know, the case studies you choose to rebuild and the latest work that you choose to show probably helps like level set expectations of any new talent that comes in. But like, you know, as you said, scaling quickly to scale is not necessarily the way to go. It's, you know, you got to earn it through projects or diversification of kind of your portfolio or the, you know, your services.
Yeah, I think if I look back, I mean, culturally Sweden's very different. It's very people centric. One of the reasons I joined Above or HAL back then was just how I felt in the interview process. They had a really interesting portfolio and they did beautiful products and had interesting brands. So it was a good career fit. But meeting, you know, Casper in particular, who was my first boss, who I'm really close friends with now, I was like, I want to work with this guy. He just set the tone. And I was like, I can work with this guy. And you're doing a lot of hours. You're putting a lot of energy, a lot of passion in to try and do your best work. And I just felt that he was a great guy and this is a great environment where I was going to feel appreciated and accepted to go and do that. I never remember. Obviously, I grew closer to the business through that 8 years, right? So I know a lot more about the last couple of years and maybe the early days, but we never had a discussion around we have a revenue target or we've got to bring this business in. It was always around we want to do a project with these guys or we really want to do a project like this or we want to work on the intersection between technology and art, like what they did with humans or Clock 24. Was really just passion driven. And I don't think that's a good business model, but I think it's a fantastic way of creating a great culture and growing a business to a certain scale. And then you need to obviously, you know, maybe be a bit more targeted, but that passion really kind of fueled that early growth. And that's all I remember. And that's why it was such a fantastic place to be.
I think you could potentially balance those though. Like you can be creatively led, but then business case enabled, you know what I mean? So if you're defining passion projects and the kind of work that you're going to do, that's building the image of the company, that's building the creative capabilities, the competence, the reputation, whatever you want to call it. But then flip the script a bit, you know, usually business guys are the ones that lead and tell you the way it is. And this is the budget you got. And these are the numbers you need to hit. But let's flip the script and say, no, you've got to make this business model work with the kinds of projects that we want to work on. Help us to define what that looks like. That's an interesting kind of take on it.
Yeah, that's like my impulse at this kind of moment for Playing Co is to look to our other designers. You know, that we doubled in size last year. So we got 3 full-time designers in the office where I'm sitting.
Show Rhino the studio.
Yeah, so yeah.
This is our little Malmo studio.
Oh, nice.
It's sweet.
This is great.
Cool little spot. Yeah, to get back to the point I was going to make was, you know, my impulse is to look towards for the business, for a design, you know, consultancy, for a creative business to create redundancy for, you know, work-life balance. You know, people can take vacations and to like grow. My impulse is to go towards them and find out what will keep them here and keep them efficient and like what type of project we want to be going after. And I think like, it's interesting to hear that the passion of finding projects that are going to interest the team, create, you know, the space where they really want to put their creative energies seems like a really smart approach to, you know, the eventuality is growth when you take that path.
Can I ask you something, Rhino, on the whole thing about being maybe a little bit more creatively and passion driven when you say, oh, an art meets technology piece. If that's just something that is in people's minds and they're like, wouldn't that be cool? What's the action then? Is it that Casper then goes, right, let's just list 10 potential companies or whatever and like hit them up? Is it like outreach and then whipping together some case studies? Like how does that typically happen?
I mean, we used to do that all the time, like just sit down as a team, as a small team back then, and really say, who do we want to work with? What are we excited by? And I think to your point, Jason, if you can bring in a project like that, you don't need to motivate the team because that's what they want. And you know that they're probably going to do some of their best work because it's a different kind of motivation. And I'd be very honest. I think we had a few projects and a few clients that, you know, we made no money on, but it was just, this is important to us and we actually believe in their mission. You know, the value for us will be that it's in our portfolio. We won't do too many of them. That's not good business practice, but I definitely think that, you know, if it aligns with your brand and people are passionate about it, that, you know, that there's one thing that companies can do and can facilitate every now and then. And so we did that for sure. And that was a big part of building our portfolio. And as we grew, above are probably reap the rewards and actually bringing in even more clients that they're more aligned with and that they actually want to work with because of that work. So, you know, where you maybe lose a little bit of revenue, you actually have a brand building moment and also can pitch into more companies that you're passionate about long term. So I think it's a bit of a snowball effect if it goes well.
Yeah, one thing you said once upon a time when I think our Concept Rise project came out that Jason initiated, and I remember you saying something to me like, oh man, I'd just love to have more time to do projects like this. And that's the kind of thing that when we've had the ability and the means, we've done projects like that. So, and they've always netted us conversations, business.
But that's really hard to do though, Brendan, right? Because you know that there's like, there's no money at the end of it. And I'm not saying that because that's the most important thing. But, you know, you're running a company and you've got to pay salaries. So you're like, there's no money at the end. We really want to do it. But your auto, at least for me, like your automatic mode is to go on LinkedIn, reach out, crunch, and you're just like blasting out full business development mode, which I hate, by the way.
Did you have to do that?
A little bit every now and then. Yeah. Yeah. I was much more, I think I just really loved getting close to clients and figuring out how you can add value. And it just became a normal conversation like what we're having now. And then if they want to give you a project, they'll give you a project. That for me is like, it feels comfortable. And this like cold outreach was never my thing. Tried many times, was successful at times, but it doesn't come naturally to me personally. I think it comes back to culture a little bit, right? Like that you're open to that risk and that you back yourselves a little bit, that short term, nothing's going to come out of this, but long term, that's what we're aiming for. We're building into something bigger here. And I think that was a really good example of that. You got to back yourselves and play the long game.
When you were talking about applying to jobs and like struggling to get a fit in a market, which was also changing at that moment, I think I just hit at the right time going through school. I took an extended path to graduation. I went to design school for 9 years and 5 different colleges. So like I had sort of almost a product design degree and then ended up going to Art Center for Transportation Design. I think I hit at the right time with the internet and like creative portfolios. If you double down on yourself and put your work out there, somebody could find you because it was a narrow set of search terms back then. It's way different now. So I've never in my design career applied to a position and gotten it. I've like actually never heard back from like the 2 or 3 that I did try to apply to a job. I've been recruited everywhere I've been, luckily. And it was because I'm more of like the lone wolf type where I've got to go figure out what I got to do for myself, communicate myself and let it do the work for me. It's funny that you're talking about the culture where you're at, where Above was at, is a little more kind of people friendly. I've got a buddy who I've worked next to at Tesla, who founded a studio in Finland with, you know, a large founder group. And it seemed like his old buddies from school all founded this thing and they hit the ground running. And it's so odd to me to have the ability to trust that many other minds and like maintain that connection, because that's just not my experience. It is a weird impulse to like double down on what's my thinking and how do I express what I think the future is, to try to advertise it through work where I want to go next. Sometimes you got to give some away for free to put the stepping stones that get to where you're really trying to get, and just trust that if you put it out there properly, the world will see it. I think it's different when you're talking about a design studio and managing the motivations of a team and like, how do you do that? I think that's definitely the struggle, but I think we're in a really great spot is what I feel like right now. And just hearing your experience from your time at Above.
Yeah, it's so good to hear.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry we're picking your brains on Above, because it's probably the closest to home for us.
Can I say something? Because I think it's always very interesting. You guys probably look at Above, and I think Above's an incredible place. But it's always...
grass is always greener.
Well, you would never look at Play & Co. in the same way that I would look at Play & Co. So for me, look at Play & Co., I'm like, fucking hell. Like 3 quarters ago, there was none of this on the website. And then there's this transformation, right?
Correct answer.
So I'm not saying... I genuinely believe that, because I think that it's been quite nice to see Play & Co.'s journey from afar. Like we would catch up a couple of times a year. We'd have a chat, what's going on, talk about life, bit about work. And then disappear. And we've done that for quite a while now. It's been a few years, right?
Yeah, for a decade at least, I reckon.
So I think when you see like the leaps that maybe Above make, everybody else is seeing Play & Co. make that leap, right? You're so close to it that you don't see it in the same way.
Yeah.
You just keep going, right? And Above will always look at some of the bigger old design houses. Play & Co. will always look at whatever's next on your growth agenda. And somebody else is looking at Play & Co. going, fuck me, I would love to work at Play & Co. They're killing it. So it's just a matter of perspective.
Well, thank you.
Honestly, I've got a frog in my throat. Hang on.
Getting choked up.
I promise.
It's since Jason's come on board, like since it's really nice to see from sapling of an idea, napkin sketch, like me and Karen and, you know, going to lunch with Jason when we're back in Teed days and we're like, you know what, fuck it, we're going to give it a go. And then having some ideas, right? And having a hypothesis of what a vision could be. then, you know, a few years later, Jason comes on board and, you know, you go through that whole taking in whatever work you can take, making the most of it, presenting it in its best light, building slowly. And it's very, very slow, mind you, when it's only two people with, you know, a handful of contractors. By the way, you two both worked on the same project at one point. You remember that luggage one?
We did.
Yeah.
And then Jason comes on board, and what Jason did really well, and I'm sure I've said this countless times, but he went through all of our backlog of work and just picked things out and said, hey, this is awesome, and it just really aligned himself with the company. I think he was born to be at Play & Co, and then he just kind of took it to the next level, which you saw, and then we bought in some marketing, and then we got messaging sorted, who we, you know, what our values are, what our real kind of reason to exist is. And then, you know, when Matt came on board, he basically just threw gas on the fire last year and brought this whole storytelling brand world to the next level. I'm like, we know, but the year before, literally Jason and I were developing branding identities, and Karen as well, and we're like, oh, you know, we can do this. And then Matt comes on, I'm like, oh, what were we even thinking?
We were just trying to buy our way up to that moment where we could bring in somebody at the level we know is, you know, world class.
It's such a good feeling when you can bring people like that in, right?
Yeah. It's the same with Tyler, right, Jason? It's really nice when you can bring people in who do the work better than we've ever done. And then my role changes now because I need to start thinking about all the different, how these pieces come together to create better work and more of it. To your point about looking to above or looking at outside agencies and going, oh, fuck you, they're killing it. I had that moment about Play & Co when we launched the site just over Christmas. I'm looking back at it and I'm just staring at it. And I'm like, it helped that we had someone who's a brand person who really kind of built this new identity and system and story for the company. It's the dawn of a new era, you know?
It's super exciting. I also think that, you know, just being a creative, when you're so close to something and it's like your hands on it, you're never really happy with it, right? So I think that helps give you a different perspective, right? You were maybe able to look at your own brand from a little bit further away.
Yeah. And what's been really nice is there's been some implicit things in the Play & Co ethos, identity that we talk about on a daily basis, like about optimism and things like that. And, you know, we believe that doesn't matter who we work for, you know, whether it's a mobility project or a consumer health project, there's kind of a past plus future equals now. There's a bit of a mid-century meets future tech is the right solution for today. And Matt took that and added some sound design to a lot of our socials. So when you start to see that, you'll pick up themes in the sound and it feels really cool and quirky. And you know, there's just a lot of ingredients we're starting to dial up in a very subtle way, experiential way that people won't say, oh, that's a color or that's a this or that's a that, but it's an experience. So that's the challenge.
Yeah, but I think that's really important. Like, I talk a lot about that with the team. I think working on a lot of projects through your career where you're maybe playing with the same ingredients as everyone else, and it really comes down to how you deliver that, right, from a product experience perspective. So yeah, if you do ANC or whatever it is, it becomes kind of like a, I think in the US you say table stakes, like a just a hygiene factor experience. You know, what you're left with as a creative is like, how do you deliver that to the end user and how can you curate that experience? And I think it's the same for a brand and an agency, right? On paper, you know, you do ID, you do visualization, you do branding, but it's really like how you pull that together and how you work with your client to bring ideas to life. That's your secret sauce as an agency.
To that end, Rhino, I don't know how long you've got. We've only got 4 minutes left on here, but if you've got a bit more time, I'd love to keep it going for a bit.
The little guy's in bed, so all good.
I just want to make sure you get your beauty sleep, mate. I know you've read that book. What's that book called? Why We Sleep?
Oh, yeah.
I was kind of brazenly telling you a couple of years ago, oh, yeah, I'd get by on about 4 or 6 hours sleep a night. And you're like, oh, that's not fucking good, mate. And then you gave me that book, and I'm like, oh, okay. So I do sleep longer now, but getting onto the beauty thing, and you said the secret sauce, one of the things we spoke about a couple of years ago, and Jason's very familiar with this topic, is that one of the catalysts to start Play & Co was what we saw was many agencies, I'm not going to say all, trying to quantify the value of design at a certain time in history. So they were trying to put metrics around it, which to some degree, metrics are important, quantifiable data metrics, etc. I think it was blown up by UX design and having data. So you could tangibly sort of do A/B testing and a lot of things in the digital creative space that you couldn't have probably done with, you know, semantics and form and whatever semiotics. But we spoke about, you know, what the secret sauce would be, you know, what's the magic. And I've always been a kind of inspired by Italian design, right? Vespas over, say, BMWs, you know, they maybe don't function the best, but they look beautiful and they have a whole more of a cultural kind of relevance. And you mentioned to me about the intern that came from Italy to Above. I don't know if you remember this story. Intern that came to Above and she was ex-Armani or something like that. She was a fashion designer. And you guys brought her in because she had, because of that background, and she had a very specific opinion on design versus, industrial design versus fashion design. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
I can't believe you can remember this. That's crazy. Yeah, but I actually have a more, in the team that I'm leading right now at Loop, we have a couple of former fashion designers, which become a little bit the glue in the team between kind of CMF and industrial design. I find it fascinating, the inspiration they bring to the table. It scares the hell out of me as an industrial designer, but it's so valuable how they just come with a completely different perspective on inspiration for a topic. So we're designing a lot of wearables. It's quite an intimate product. It goes in your ear, it goes on your face. I think with wearables in general, there's kind of like this extra attention needed between the object and the relationship with the human, and not just functionally how it operates, but how it makes you feel and how it kind of either disappears or becomes a tool for you to navigate through the day. And so to approach that from an industrial design perspective, I think you get one lens on what that can look and feel like. And then to bring in a fashion designer or somebody who does furniture or an architect, you get a completely different perspective and a completely different set of ingredients that can inspire different solutions. I just find that really, really interesting. And one of my first, who I was inspired by when I was at university, was Mark Newson. And I read his book. If I remember correctly, he was studying jewelry design, and he was doing all this furniture for his degree show or whatever it was back then, and sort of made this argument around, well, it's surrounding your body. It is a piece of jewelry. It just inspired a completely different direction of what that object could be and what it stands for. And I think now it's quite a lot of consistency in product design execution. And I think by bringing in people into your team that have a different perspective can just really help your brand differentiate and come up with new ideas that help you stand out in the market, but also just be a bit more meaningful to people who want to buy and wear your products.
That's what I would say, like my time in footwear, it was always crazy seeing these older designers who are still kind of like straddling that industrial design, but also kind of that fashion thing where it's like there's a self-expression part of that job that fuels a certain type of creative that lasts in that industry. The ones that can balance that with mass manufacture and like industrial design principles are the ones that find like the sweet spot of products that sell through and, you know, carry a business. I was really lucky to have that experience because automotive is very different. A lot of it is about politics and glory of like getting the right sketch picked. And, you know, you jump in status big time if you get a program assigned to you. Brendan, when you talk about the origins of Playing Co., I do remember you at one point said like weaving Teague to go start one. It was not necessarily like we can do this better. It was like if we could find a couple of the right talents to fuel the right people, we're good. And I think that's, we've stayed pretty true to that, is like, you know, the concept projects over the years was you guys like fueling me and keeping me satiated for like my creative output. I think that's what we've done well with the team. We got to continue to do well. It's like people, performance, profits, man.
But I think you started with that as well, right? Like bringing you in, Jason, I think you were the first one in right after Brendan and Karen. You're coming with a footwear background and automotive perspective. Similar skills, but different way of looking at things. I think it's super valuable. And I remember through our discussions, Brendan, like every time you brought someone new in, you were like obviously very happy and stoked about it, but you would always pinpoint like there's this one thing that they do and they're really, really good at it. And you would be super excited about that's what this person is going to bring. And I know there's a bunch of like baseline stuff that you need to be able to do as a creative, but there was always this one thing that you're like, that person is bringing this to Play&Co, and I'm really excited about it. And I think, you know, as you grow, you get to bring more individuals in with those different perspectives. And I think one, it's fun selfishly to just work with people like that, but I think it's also great to build an agency around that ethos as well.
I want to bring this back to where you're at now then, because we've spoken a little bit about your time at Above and some of the lessons of going from small team to big team. Can you talk about what you're finding in terms of building out a creative team as design director in your new role?
I moved to a company called Loop Earplugs, which is headquartered in Belgium. But I actually work out of Stockholm, so I'm a remote worker. So I travel quite frequently there. I moved there for many, many small reasons, no big ones. I loved Above. It was fantastic. There was not really a reason for me to leave. I just felt that I'd been in agency for a while. I was kind of craving to go in-house. And also, I think I'm just really motivated by learning as much as I possibly can. And, you know, Loop came in, very, very small team. It was 4 designers, 2 ID, 2 CMF, no leadership team, very little structure, no process. And I was hired via Above to work with them for a while, for 8-9 months. I think Loop was probably around 100.
Okay.
Just over 100. Wow. And profit organization was 25, 30. So reasonably sized, but they have a small portfolio of products at the time, but they were shipping relatively high volumes. I basically went in there, was coaching the team, bringing in some sort of like creative leadership and also building out some critical processes for them. I kind of seen under the hood, I was intrigued by the growth potential and that the ambition to do bigger and better things and be quite design centric, and that they were interested in bringing me on and sort of like spearheading that from the product design point of view. I've been there full time for a year now. Main focus has been really building a creative culture, and I've taken a lot of learnings from Brendan and Casper and design partners and actually everyone throughout my career to try and define what that should be. Bring in diversity. We have a lot of female creatives, which I'm really, really proud of. That's something we have struggled at every company I've ever been at. Actually, I think the brand really resonates with the female audience, which is fantastic. So also, we can pull in a lot of female creative talent. It's a proper challenge. It's a scale up now. We're building processes as we ship product. It's crazy and really exciting at the same time. I think definitely not for everyone. I think you really got to be up for that challenge and instill things as you go and know that next year it will change, and just be really comfortable with change, because it's, I've never experienced change at this pace. That's very new to me. And, you know, I look back, I thought that Above was changing quickly, like every year or two there was a merger or a rebrand or we opened a new studio, and Loop is like a different company every 6 months, and it's around 300 people right now. So it's,
wow,
it's crazy.
So you've tripled in company size by headcount in 12 months.
It's crazy growth. And then actually the pressure and the challenge is actually, okay, you know, we have autonomy over our company and the brand. We don't have a board of investors and we're not IPO'd or anything like that. So it's really, where do we want to invest our EBIT? How do we grow? Where do we want to grow? Where's the opportunity for the brand? And that's super interesting for me as a design director, creative director, to sort of be a part of helping the company navigate that journey through design. So
how much influence do you have over shaping the portfolio and the roadmap?
Yeah, I'm not the guy. I'm one of the guys or girls. I'm not that good, Brendan, unfortunately, but I'm definitely a part of it. And that was one of the appeals. I think we've all experienced frustrations at working at companies that don't understand or respect design. I think Loop's very passionate about design because it's been, you know, one of their critical differentiators, like earplugs. When I tell people I work at an earplug company, they're like, really?
Wah, wah.
But I think they've had massive success from design, and I think it's about trying to understand how we can scale that. It's a lot of fun, but it's a team effort. It's not just driven by design. I think you need a strong PM team, and I think that was one of the things I really took away from Philips. You guys really sitting together and looking at, okay, well, what's the portfolio? What's the business objectives? What are we trying to do here? And then how does design, you know, challenge that, facilitate that, or fuel that as an opportunity? it requires everyone at the table to work together to find the right way forward, I think, at least in my experience.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. There's no one right person or oracle that has the answers to everything.
It's very easy to sort of like bury your head away and try and solve everything yourself. And I find that the more people you talk to about a problem, the more it sort of clarifies what the underlying problem behind that actually is. It takes time, right, to connect with people and share ideas and let them share their ideas. But if you let that process unravel and you spend that time, I think you just come up with a better brief to execute better creative work, right? And if you can get the brief right earlier, and creatives are great at that because we ask some weird and wonderful questions, that really, I think, moves the needle at the end when it comes to execution. You can really focus on where the value is in a product or in a project brief.
Jason, what do you reckon? Should we throw some, like, what would you say to any young designers aspiring to be as handsome as Rhino and charismatic so that they can walk into these leadership roles without lifting a finger? There it is. He was waiting for it.
Good luck answering that.
Is it safe to assume, and this is a lesson to whoever, you know, designers of any age, shape or size, first and foremost, I've heard a lot of dialogue that consultants are a waste of money. Consultancies are a waste of money. Usually those comments don't come and are not targeted at design agencies, because what we do is we offer a work product as a service. So we're not providing a PowerPoint and saying, go figure it out yourselves. We're actually doing the bloody work. That's why I don't like calling Play & Co a consultancy. We're a studio or an agency. But the difference with an agency is that because we have a broad section of clients, to Jason's observation a few years ago, there's a lot of patterns across industries, whether you're designing a bloody elevator or a medical product or a vehicle of some sort or a printer or whatever, there are patterns across all industries that are design challenges that seem to recur, seem to come back. And so by being exposed to all of that, we can often offer solutions from other industries. And we did that a couple of years ago with the sleep health team at Philips, where it netted a couple of proprietary technologies coming from the footwear industry. It's breadth, but it's innovation advantages. Whereas when you go into corporate, into a brand, you narrow your focus, you get much better at the subject matter. But for something like Loop, this is what we did at Philips, which was really fun with the headphone portfolio, is you start to curate ranges and collections. And it's a very different kind of way of thinking about design. I didn't want to take the words out of your mouth, but is that the way you see it? I guess, how would you build on that at Loop now? Like,
it's so funny because there's a couple of former Philips people at Loop in really important positions. So I have a great designer in my team called Elodie, who's former Philips, really, really strong creative, and a very nice person. And also the director of PM, who I'm working very closely with at the moment, is Hida, who was former director of Philips Hue, I believe. And I think had a few other roles there as well. He's really been talking a lot about value spaces, right? So I think now, you know, we're an earplug company, and we would challenge that and say we're an earwear company, because I think we challenge what earplugs are. And that's basically the crux of why we've been so successful. When you look at our products, you don't think of an earplug, you think of a piece of jewelry that you wear to a concert, right?
And I'll just add some context to what you just said to Rhino. When I was a young designer, I used to go, when I'd hear people in leadership positions saying, we're not an earplugs company, we're an earwear company, I'd be like, oh, who gives a fuck? It's the same thing. But the reality is, at the highest level of company governance, that affects your messaging, that affects everything, the kind of product you do.
Yeah, I think it really inspired one of our design principles, which was non-conformist, which is to just challenge the status quo and disrupt. And I think that's like the secret sauce of what Loop did in the earplug market, right? And I would say it's earwear. And I think you might see some things in the future that really challenge what you think earplugs can be. But then, you know, if you take that sort of like that mantra or that design vision, how can you apply that to other markets that are sort of like adjacent to our brand and which we can grow and expand into? It's an interesting way of framing maybe what your opportunity landscape is, and then to empower designers to sort of just go and explore that. But to go back to your former question, I think we're starting to look at the portfolio in terms of ranges. It's nowhere near as big as what we were dealing with at Philips. So we've got a long way to go, but we've started looking at the portfolio in this hierarchical and value spaces. So where do we play? Where's our touch point in the life of the consumer? And where can we add value? And I think, you know, a lot of people know us from festivals. One of our areas is more in flow and focus and productivity and, you know, just blocking out noise and being able to navigate your way through the every day. We just recently launched a sleep product, which you could argue is, you know, recovery or health and wellness. And if you start to look at your portfolio in that way, rather than the product within that, you can start to see potential like future ecosystems of products that could coexist and connect the dots between, you know, the day and the life of a Loop user or consumer. And then you need to figure out where you think you can add value next to expand the brand and the portfolio. So that's work that we're sort of, you know, we've started and we're really ramping up into 25 because we're still learning how to do that as a brand, you know, how to do front-end innovation, how to expand the portfolio. How do we look at our portfolio? That's changed a couple of times already. So,
yeah, and I can imagine that building a team, so people that have done it before at other organizations, but bringing them together as a new team requires a whole new round of learning again. So just because I've done it over here doesn't mean it translates. It's not a cut and copy. It kind of amplifies your chance of success if you get the right people, but there's, you got to define the way that people work together and
set up that circumstance again that creates success. Yeah. After hearing you talk about it, I can see, you can feel where the brand will get asked to go, which is what's very cool. I think there's some natural places for it to, you know, once you've matured and earned the, you know, the ownership of a niche market, you'll be asked to take that approach in those peripheral or those adjacent markets. And if you deliver on those, man, you're going to be on a fun ride.
I hope so. We're gearing up for it at least.
Well, man, long overdue, but man, really, really great meeting you. Really fun conversation.
We should do it again, whether we record it or not. I mean, I would love to just pick your brain, Jason, and I feel like I've known of you for like 10 years or 8 years or however long it's been, but this is the first time we've actually been on a call together. And
yeah, it feels like we know each other already, which is cool.
You guys feel free to connect. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you will. But if you want me on there as well,
do it. Do you know, can I share one story that I shared with my team? I missed quite a few things in your questions, and this is going to make Brendan look really good. So he'll enjoy this. It's a good one to wrap up on. Two things to share for like younger, junior, up and coming designers. One was something you taught me. I remember when we were at Philips, I was, we said before in the headphone team. I'm biased, but I think those were some of the most interesting projects at the time in Philips. I think I did some of the DJ headphones, and then Brendan was kind to kind of ease me into the Philips O'Neill partnership, which was probably the most exciting out of all. And I never forget there was a project that came up, and it was the little inline controller that you had on your headphone cables to do like volume up, down and skip and stuff. I looked at that and I was like, fuck no, do I want to do that? That's the most boring thing you could possibly do. I want to go and do the new whatever it was, Philips O'Neill, you can drive over it, indestructible headphone. You just quietly took that project away. And then I watched you work on it over a few weeks, and I watched you talk to like Michael Direct, and he was maybe the UX consultant. He's still actually at Philips, he's like director of UX, and really like churn through the details and properly turn this thing inside out to really figure out like what is the interaction paradigm. What's consistent with industry standards? What can we own from a Philips perspective? You know, what can we do with that? And I just remember thinking, that's the most boring product. I don't want to be on it. I never said it, but I was thinking it. And through the process of watching you work on it, by the end of it, I was jealous I was not on the program. And I think for me, like the biggest takeaway is even the most boring projects, there is a design opportunity and there is an opportunity to do better. And I think especially in the start of your career, you're not going to get all the juicy stuff. Like really, like take care and attention over what you do get, and have fun, but take it serious. And I think that was something I really took away from you. That was a really big one.
I think that's, we share that, and that working, I think Brennan and Karen come together as a package because she's always in his head, and he passes that on to us. But like you get wired differently after working around him or working, you know, under his leadership. You challenge everything. So Brendan never shoots from the hip. It's always dig back in and sort of rebrief, reframe. And I think that's one of the things I took away from my experience is what led to successes that gave me experience to come back that were valuable to bring back to Planco, you know? And that's why it's, you know, it's frustrating probably for us to work together sometimes because like we're both digging into the problem sometimes from different perspectives, different experience. And we're passing that along to the team here. And sometimes, you know, it takes a while to dig through a problem, even if it seems mundane, but every single one of those can matter, I think it's a great lesson.
Yeah. I mean, take care and think critically, right? Really challenge it. I think that's super, it's super important. And I think it's way more rewarding for you as a creative to come out the other side of that process and look at how you've made an impact, you know?
The right people will sit and will look at the work, even if it is something as mundane as an inline controller or a headphone jack or a splitter or whatever. And I remember I learned that there too from guys above me, and I just saw the way that they were. It wasn't so much about the product, it was about the process and just the way that the things were presented and the three core functional elements of that thing and just how beautifully they would the attention was to detail. Yeah, that's something that lives with you. So yeah, I think that's a really good lesson to young designers. If you're working on something like a trash can, you can make an exquisite looking trash can. Think about, you know, the basics. Get back to basics.
This is not me bashing anyone, but you know, you look at furniture design. I mean, the chairs have been around a while, right? But we keep coming up with new ways of sitting down and new ways to experience sitting down or resting, relaxing, being productive. And I think there's just endless opportunity in everything. So if you spend the time, you'll find the opportunity within a program.
Totally.
Yeah, that's probably a bad example.
Yeah.
You get what
yours
I mean.
Yours is way shitter than my trash can one.
Oh, dude.
It's been fun, Rhino. Any final thoughts, Jason? Or
No. Let's connect again. I know you asked a couple of questions, like wanted to see how we handle being in separate places. I'd love to talk to. I'd love to hear how, yeah, what it's like managing as many creatives as you do. Just learn some new lessons.
Yeah, fair dinkum. I think to echo that, like, see, Jason is an extension of Karen and I. I think the value that you can get from us is the value that we can get from you. You know, just comparing notes. I think there's a lot that we can learn from each other. So
yeah, I love that.
Our virtual door's always open, mate. You know that.
Likewise.
All right, mate. Hey, have a great year at Loop. We're excited to see what you do with it, and we'll chat soon.
All right. Take care.
See you, man.
Bye.
Bye.